How are you, Chris? You're right.
Very well, thank you, Julian. Lovely to see you.
And you as well. So I'm a bit cold. I've got a blanket today. I am up. It's just, I got up and now it's freezing cold. So
I think we've had the summer.
I think that's it. Yeah, you're right. So, yeah. Right. So I do a little bit of an introduction and then we'll just have a chat about Zen. So I did feel a bit intimidated when Rosie says you can interrogate me. So like, I don't know anything about Zen. Okay. Right. Here we go. Welcome to the Go Health podcast. I'm Gillian Strain, Chief Exec of Go Health, an organization with a vision to enable churches and individual Christians to be a healing presence in the world. And in the Go Health podcast, well, it's our gift into the world. It's where we have conversations that inspire and empower us through stories and wisdom about how to flourish in faith by chatting to people with unique insights and stories to share. And this episode, we are chatting with the Reverend Chris Collingwood, a Christian priest, former canon of York Minster, and a Zen master. Chris, welcome to the podcast. I'm really pleased to be chatting with you today. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Julian. Thank you so much. It's a joy and a delight to be with you. Thanks so much for asking me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, me too. And Chris, we've met before, haven't we?
Yeah.
So I came to one of your retreats. So this is great to be reconnecting as well. And I think we're going to chat about that as well. Or I'd certainly like to, because you've been on quite a spiritual journey, haven't you? Priest, master, where did it all begin? Can you first recall when you first felt called to this way of life or to be a priest?
Well, I grew up in a Christian family. And, you know, church going and so on was very much part of it. Sang in the church choir. I think my first sense of being called to be a priest was when I was about 14, actually. And it was a conversation with my dad in which he said he'd wanted to be a priest, but because of the Second World War, he hadn't been able to follow that through. And I suspect that sowed the seeds of an idea. School was very stimulating in terms of spirituality and so on. And then just before I got married, which I was quite young, I said to my then fiance, Sue, I've just got this strange feeling I should be ordained. And she just said, if that's what you want to do, I'm right behind you. And that was the beginning of the Christian journey. But from quite an early age, I was very interested in other spiritual traditions. Almost the first serious book I read on spirituality was by an Irish Jesuit priest called William Johnston, who was a professor of Oriental philosophy at Sophia University in Tokyo. And he was exploring the relationship between the Christian contemplative and mystical tradition and Zen. And ever since then, I've been meditating in a variety of traditions. Going to India was really important for me, and going to the ashram that was led by Bede Griffiths, who was an English Roman Catholic Benedictine monk. And that ashram still is very much open to engagement and dialogue and learning from people of traditions other than Christianity, particularly Hinduism. Mm-hmm. And then Zen, I suppose it was really when I actually met proper Zen teachers.
Yeah.
That's really what started it off.
So most of our listeners, I think, will be, they'll know what a Christian priest is, or they'll have a good handle on it, right? But could you just summarize what is Zen for like the complete beginner in a few sentences, if you can? Like, so what are we talking about here?
Zen is really a practice which invites us to wake up to who we really are. Mm. At the heart of it is Zazen, which is sitting meditation. It's so unbelievably simple that most people think there's got to be more to it than this. And part of the practice is wrestling with all that. So, you know, we sit traditionally on a mat and a cushion or on a chair, and we simply pay attention to our breath. We just follow our breath in and out, and thoughts arise. We don't try to banish them. We just let them be. But we keep on just coming back to the breath. And little by little, we find that this kind of unmasks us. So when I say it's about waking up to who we really are, you know, we identify ourselves with so many different things in so many different ways. But I suppose at the heart of it, Zen is just about being completely, totally present here and now with whatever is going on, whatever is arising, characterized by ultimately by the sense that we are much more than we think we are. And it's the thinking which is often the problem. And when we realize that we're much more than that, we discover our interconnectedness with everything and everyone, which gives rise to a sense of compassion, which enables us then to act in ways which seek to avoid adding to the suffering of the world.
Right. That's the thank you. I want to dip into all those different things. But before we sort of get into the theory and the practice really of Zen, because there's so much there. And I'm thinking this sounds a bit like the contemplative, you know, bit of Christianity.
Yeah, absolutely.
To become a Christian priest, you study a theological college.
Yeah.
And then are ordained in the Anglican Church by a bishop.
Mm-hmm.
And do certain things, right? How do you become a Zen master? Let me just, because you've got this double title here.
As a practitioner of Zen, you become a student of a Zen teacher. And what that really means is that you commit yourself to learning from, to practicing with that teacher, that master. And I suppose there are two strands to it, really. One is called koan study, which means that you sit with classic stories, which are about exchanges between Zen masters and monks, or two Zen masters, or whoever, and you really allow the awareness of the Zen master in the koan to become yours. So that's quite a long process. The other strand is what's called shikantaza, which is just sitting, which in a way is what I described when you asked me about, you know, what Zen is, and I talked about zazen.
Yeah.
And so you basically talk to your teacher, you reveal your practice, and little by little, the teacher might say, well, I think, you know, you'd make a good teacher, or not. I mean, in my case, as it happens, my Zen teacher, who also was a Roman Catholic priest, said to me one day, I've got great plans for you, Chris. And I didn't have a clue what he was talking about. We were sitting in our kitchen in York. And Sue, my wife, said to me, he's going to make you a Zen teacher. And I said, don't be so ridiculous. And sure enough, he did. And one of the things about him was that he had amazing faith and confidence in me, even when I hadn't got it in myself. So he could see something in me which he thought would make a good Zen teacher.
And Chris, if Christianity started with the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, is it possible to briefly say where Zen started and comes from?
Yeah, Zen is ultimately grounded in the experience of Siddhartha Gautama, known as Shakyamuni Buddha, it's a wonderfully inspirational story, because he grew up in a privileged situation. He was expected to become the leader of his tribe. He was going to be a king, but he encountered, so the story goes, he encountered sickness, old age, and death almost for the first time, and was deeply disturbed by it. So when this prompted him to make a spiritual search, which lasted for 5 or 6 years, in utter exasperation, when he felt that he was no nearer what he was looking for, he just sat down against a Bodhi tree and said, I'm not going to get up until I've found what I'm looking for. So there's something there about this meditation posture. He basically sat down and he was still. Again, the story goes that when he caught sight of the morning star, he had an awakening, and he realized that he wasn't separate from anything or anyone. That's not to say that he wasn't distinct, but he wasn't separate. Everything was profoundly interconnected. Mm. The tradition has it that he said, I, the great earth, and all beings simultaneously attain enlightenment. So the practice of Zen is about waking up to the fact that we are all already enlightened, which I suppose corresponds in the Christian tradition to two things, perhaps. The first, the affirmation that we're created in the image and likeness of God. The second would be, if I went to St. John's Gospel, I would start with the prologue where it says that all things come into being in Christ, all things. And without him, not one thing came into being. There's no separation. On the surface level, they're different.
Yeah.
But there's a great convergence.
So I want to get into some of this. What does that mean to awaken to yourself, this non-duality and things? But before we do that, in praxis, Chris, you are a canon of one of the most...
I know what's coming.
Senior, like, you're a minister, man.
Yeah, yeah.
And a Zen teacher. You know, how did that work? Where were the clashes? And where did you see flourishing in the two coming together?
Yeah, yeah, that's a really, really good question. Initially, when I went to York, I mean, I was quite upfront when I first met the Archbishop on interview and the Dean and my chapter colleagues, future chapter colleagues. I'm quite upfront about the fact that I practiced Zen. One of them on interview said to me, oh, you mean a bit like Thomas Merton? I said, yes, exactly like Thomas Merton. The great 20th century Trappist monk, Cistercian monk. I decided to set up, with the help of my then teacher, a Zen group. And we had the first time, just as an information gathering thing, there were 50 people who came. I mean, it was absolutely astonishing. And then when my own teacher said that he was going to make me a teacher, what's called giving transmission, my chapter colleagues were, and the Archbishop, were very supportive. When people hear the word Zen, particularly if they're from a rather more conservative tradition, they get a bit worried. So there were people who were unhappy about it, and they complained and, said that I should resign.
And what do you think they were unhappy about, Chris? Because they're not the same, are they, Zen and Christianity?
No, they're not.
There's clashes. What were they, what were they upset about? And I guess also, where do you see these two clashing, or do you see them clashing? Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I understand why people get worried and concerned, because, within the Christian tradition, there's very much the strong sense, you are wholeheartedly committed in one direction, and you can't deviate. And a lot of the biblical stories, contains issues where people have, as it were, deviated from, the straight path. Mm. Jesus says you can't serve two masters. I think so. I understand why people get a bit worried. There's also the sense that in Christianity, I loved theology, absolutely loved it. But theology, the kind of mental, intellectual process, is only one dimension of who we are. And Christianity is, it kind of prioritizes that dogmatic perspective in many ways. So if it looks as though you are affirming another path or another tradition, then it looks as though you're weakening, you're diminishing the Christian perspective. But I think I would want to say that in many ways it's precisely a Christian perspective which invites us to be open to the other. So if we take, for example, the well-known story of the Good Samaritan, historically at the time, Jews and Samaritans loathed one another. And yet in that story, it's the Samaritan that Jesus commends as the one who is being open to what the law, the Jewish law, is really all about in going to the assistance of somebody who's injured and seemingly left for dead. And I think also in the doctrine of the Trinity, there's this sense of sameness and difference, so that there's diversity within the Trinity, which I think for me is the basis for being open to that which is different. So Zen is different from Christianity in the sense that it doesn't actually require any kind of dogmatic assertion. It doesn't require that you say, I affirm that the Buddha is better than Jesus or anything like that. It's a much more contemporary, almost a scientific process. You almost don't take anything on trust. You test everything out. So anything that's given to you in the teaching, you test it out in your own experience and you see whether it adds up or not. And for me, there is a huge convergence, particularly in the way that we approach suffering, for example. Jesus on the cross, goes to the cross voluntarily and willingly. I mean, it must have been horrendous, absolutely horrendous, the physical pain and the rejection, knowing that the establishment is rejecting you completely. And Zen, you see, is also about how do we deal with that? How do we actually live in a world where there is so much suffering and seek not to let it overwhelm us? So there are different practices, but I think there's a huge convergence in all this.
I read somewhere that you don't learn what Zen is, you experience what Zen
Absolutely.
Is. It's part of the experience. So am I right in thinking, well, so we don't have to dispose of what the Christian faith teaches us in terms of salvation? I think salvation, mm-hmm. it's kind of the could be the big one, really.
Yeah.
And lots of people define that in different ways.
Yes.
We don't have to dispose of that, do we? It's just
Not
about...
At all.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think Zen is... I mean, this is where, we can get into so much difficulty with the words and the concepts. And Zen is always steering us away from getting hooked on the concepts and the ideas and the thoughts and so on. That salvation, for me, you see, as you will know well, Gillian, has its roots in notions of wholeness and health. Holiness, all these things are connected. We speak of a salve, which is something which heals. So salvation is about healing. Zen is in a way about healing, could be seen to be about healing something which we all experience, which is the sense of inner division, of separation, the way that we act out conflict and so on. And what we discover when we're sitting zazen is that there's something, as it were, deeper and beyond that it includes and enfolds all these things, and yet at another level it's none of them. So you're absolutely right that we don't have to jettison any part of the Christian faith as practitioners of Zen.
I want to talk about the experience of Zen because I went on a Zen retreat in which you were leading, and that was, you know, that blew my head. So I want to talk about that just before we turn there. But it was just good, the practice. Some would say, right, salvation is about Jesus Christ.
Yeah, yeah.
How would you respond to that? Or, you know, you meet someone in the street or somewhere, I guess, Chris, and you see they're in spiritual need. They're suffering an existential crisis. I mean, in some ways of the world right now, we're all suffering a bit because, you know, there's many things to, you know, the world's a tough place. You meet someone and you've got your two hats, you Christian priest, Zen hat. I don't know if Zen people wear hats, but, you know, what do you say to them? Like, what do you go with when you meet someone? I know it's theoretical, but, you know.
It's a very practical question, which we all meet. I mean, I think I would say the same in every situation. You have to be sensitive to where people are, and you have to, in one sense, kind of discern. You have to work out what's really motivating this person. Where's the question coming from? What are they really asking about? I mean, in Zen, you see, very often you get in these koans, you get somebody asking a question.
Yeah.
Let me give you the obvious one to start with, which is one that most students will begin with. A monk asks Joshu, a Zen master, does a dog have Buddha nature? And Joshu responds, mu, M-U, which means not or nothing. Now, the thing is that the monk had been taught quite correctly that orthodox Buddhist dogma is that all beings are endowed with Buddha nature. So when he says, does a dog have Buddha nature? Maybe he's sort of got a vision of the monastery dog, which is a bit skanky and, you know, what have you. Really, this dog? Has this dog got Buddha nature? But at heart, what Joshu really knew he was asking is, do I have Buddha nature? Am I endowed with Buddha nature? Really? I know what I'm like. You know, I'm this dreadful, inadequate person. You know, do I really have Buddha nature? So when somebody asks me a question, I mean, I'm not going through all that. You know, are they asking me about Buddha nature? But I'm trying to kind of fathom, where is this person really coming from? Now, if that person is somebody, for argument's sake, just as an example, who has been damaged and hurt, wounded by the church, as we know many people have, particularly through abuse, whether it's sexual abuse or the abuse of power, you know, people are very, very wary. And if they ask about, salvation in Jesus Christ, if they've come from an experience where the answer to that question has been mixed up somehow with abuse, then an intellectual answer perhaps isn't going to suffice. It may be that actually talking through with somebody, you know, about their experience and being sympathetic and compassionate and understanding, that might help. But equally, it might be, from a Zen perspective, one would say something like, we are all endowed with Buddha nature. We are all truly, truly alive, awake, connected. We might then find ourselves saying, we are all truly our Christ nature. You know, going back to John's gospel, all things were created in and through him. So that from a Christian perspective, we're waking up, if you like, to the presence of Christ within us. And that then seems to me to be the beginning of salvation, because it's the it's this very deep kind of relationship with that which is, in one sense, both other than we are and also exactly who we are. And that's where we get into the, you know, the difficulties with the language. Why, as you said, it has to be experienced rather than just talked about.
And what's in my head right now hearing you talk about all this is some of the work that Jim Finley has mm-hmm. been doing. He gets name checks a lot on this podcast. And he, of course, was he worked with Merton.
Yes.
And very much from the contemplative and the psychotherapeutic background. But he often, when he leads stuff, he prays and, you know, talks about God as never, 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 never not loving us. I know, and I love the repeated never.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of, it's waking you up, isn't it, to how loved we are. We just often forget it so often. And that, I can see the strong interconnections with the Christian contemplative. It's just a tuning in, noticing.
Absolutely.
And I
think also, you see, to come back to this question about salvation in Jesus Christ, I mean, you will know just as well as I do that there are all sorts of any number of different kind of theories of what Jesus's death on the cross is all about. I mean, one of those is that, you know, we're such kind of dreadful sinners that we need somebody else to sort us out. And of course, that has its value. There's an impact there. But equally, it seems to me if we go back beyond that, you know, the way that we are, our creation is that, you know, God brings us into being because God loves us. God delights in us. God takes infinite joy in who we are. Whatever we do in our lives, and we all get into messes, we all get into difficulties. But, you know, that, as you just said with Jim Finley, you know, God never, 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 never stops loving us. I mean, that, I believe to be true, absolutely true of every single human being. I mean, that's a real challenge because there are some human beings that we all find, I mean, to put it mildly, incredibly difficult.
Yes.
But I think this is where Zen is so helpful because it keeps on probing the question, but who are you really?
Really,
who are you? Are you this person who just fouls things up, who makes a mess of life? Or are you something, as it were, beyond that, more than that, in another sense, less than that? Are you not that? Are you this? And in Zen, we talk about emptiness. You know, our true nature is empty, which means that we can't finally pin it down. We can't categorize it or define it. There is this amazing, you know, when we're sitting zazen, when we're meditating, and when the mind is still, or even when the mind isn't still, we can become aware of this extraordinarily creative, energetic potential that's within us, that is who we are, which then manifests itself in our daily lives in all sorts of ways. So to go on asking that question, I think that's what the monk meant when he said, you know, does this dog have Buddha nature? You know, he's saying, who am I really? And when Joshua gives the answer, mu, no or not, you can't categorize it. There's no concept there. All you are left with is me. This is who I am. You know, this is what reality is. And it's absolutely not egocentric. It's the reverse.
So let's talk about that, kind of the practice side of it as well. So I went earlier this year to a week-long session. That's how you pronounce it?
Session, yeah.
Session.
Yeah,
yeah. Which is a week-long silent retreat, Zen style. And I came home from that and my husband noticed how peaceful I was.
Mm.
I felt peaceful. So it was an experience which had an impact. And when I arrived, I remember, you know, a couple of things. How alien the room looked like.
Yeah.
You know, as a Christian, I'm quite used to churches.
Yeah.
I know where the pews are, what's going to happen, liturgy and all the rest of it. I walked in, the room looked really different. There was mats on the ground, cushions to sit on. There was incense going on. There was pictures of the Buddha. There's pictures of Jesus. We're all set up facing each other across the style. And I remember that one of the first things you said, Chris, was it doesn't matter if you get anything wrong. So that was sort of liberating. It sort of like spoke to that church bit of me that's like worried about where to sit. So that was great. And then the invitation was to, you know, sit on the mat for an hour and a half at a time with various walkings around and different things. Mm-hmm. And it left me with a deep, you know, I came away with this really sense of deep peace. And I might be wrong, but I felt it was like a spiritual version of psychotherapy to sit and work out who I was via either the silence or the teachings. We talked about one of those little story nuggets, a koan as well. So it felt a very powerful experience. And one of the things I struck with the different liturgies and prayers was this idea of non-duality.
Yeah.
This awakening to ourselves, sitting in silence, sitting with yourself, but an awakening to non-duality. That's quite un-Christian language. Could you say a bit about what that means and why in particular for you that was something that was attractive?
Yeah. Yes, non-duality is very much a kind of an Eastern philosophical notion. We find it in Hinduism and in Buddhism. Of course, in Zen, non-duality isn't primarily something that we're working out intellectually. It's something that we experience, and it's quite important not to assume that non-duality is the opposite of duality. Because if we set up non-duality as an alternative to duality, then we're still in the realm of duality. We're just setting up something else that's not dual, if you see what I mean.
And Chris, what does dual mean? So this way of thinking, so splitting two things,
two things. And of course, our everyday life is quite substantially that of duality. You know, we experience this and that.
Yeah, us and them.
Us and them, exactly. Yeah. You
good
know,
and
we're about to come up to a general election, you know.
Yeah, a lot of us and
this
them.
Lot, or do we want that lot? Yeah, or do we want none of them?
That's a whole other podcast.
So. Yeah. So, of course, we have to make choices and all that, you know, that sort of thing. But when we're sitting Zazen, especially, this is where it's all rooted, we discover all sorts of things arising in the mind, which are unpalatable, unwelcome, unwanted. And we have a question. A question arises, what do I do with this? Do I try to kind of stop all this? Do I try to eradicate it from me? Or if I don't eradicate it, what do I do with it? Now, the reality of life is, of course, we can't eradicate it. If we try to stop thought, then we just give power to thought. Mm. So we have this paradoxical situation when we're sitting that we don't try to stop thought. We don't engage with it. We just let it arise. And we don't pay any attention to it. When we do find that we're paying attention to it, we just very gently come back to the breath. So we've got this.
So it's like open acceptance.
Yes, exactly.
Is this the same as this, the non-judgment? I read in one of the heart, the sutra as a teaching text about do not judge by any standard. So you're not even judging yourself.
No.
You're just coming at things. The practice,
absolutely.
Practice helps you come at things as they are. Is that the thing?
Yeah, completely. So. Very often we find that almost one of the last things that we have to deal with is our self-judgment. You know, we find perhaps that we can stop judging others, maybe, but that's difficult. But the self-judgment is deep within us, you know, somehow this self-criticism. And so learning just to allow all these really uncomfortable things to arise without eradicating them, without getting rid of them, without judging them, but learning to accept them with compassion and love is actually in itself transformative.
So it's self-compassion in a way.
Yes, completely.
It's all these, and this is the thing, you know, you are not your thoughts.
Yeah.
Many of the meditation traditions from all different worlds, it's sort of even just identifying a thought is not you,
yeah,
or you're separate, yeah, from it. Is that's something that happens on those mats that you sit on,
yeah,
isn't,
yeah,
it?
And we have to keep on being aware of it, you know, because we can say to ourselves, you know, I'm not my thought or whatever it might be. But, you know, if we've just had, I mean, let's say, you know, we've had a terrible run-in with somebody, might be a husband or a wife, you know, and, you know, we sit down to meditate. And we, oh, well, I'm not my thought, you know, but actually what's going on,
yeah,
you know, absolutely raging beneath it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite difficult to let that be accepted, but it is what we, that is the practice.
What if, I don't know, we don't want to get too personal about our husbands and our wives here, but what if there's a thing that needs to be, you can't just sort of get rid of all the thoughts because there's stuff to be done in the world.
Yeah, and absolutely. Things, yeah. So the whole point about the meditation is not that we do nothing.
Mm.
It's rather that we withdraw in order then to be able to see a little bit more clearly,
mm,
and to allow the really negatively charged things just perhaps to settle a little bit.
Yeah.
So that we can then say, okay, now how do I deal with this? What's the in Zen we would say, what's the wisest thing? What's the most compassionate way we can deal with this? And it may be that we go back to our husband or wife, and we say, "Oh, yeah, darling, I'm so sorry. I was totally stressed. It's nothing to do with you," or whatever it might be. Or we might think, "Do you know what? This has been a running sore all our marriage, and and I think finally we've got to deal with this one." But again, it's not, you know, I'm fed up with all this. You know, it might be. Could we? I realize that I've brought something to this. You know. Could we just sit down and talk about this without, you know, getting too upset about it? Would you be willing to do that? You know, that sort of thing. So that it's absolutely not about just sitting doing nothing ever. Zen is very much about acting compassionately in the world. But we can't do that unless, as we said a moment ago, if we haven't got compassion for ourselves, we're unlikely to find compassion for anybody else.
Sure, yeah. I was really struck about the mat. You sit on a mat. What's the mat's got a name? What's the mat called again?
Zabuton.
You sit on the mat, and your mat becomes like your universe.
Yeah, yeah.
You keep it clean and wipe bits of dirt off as well. I thought, God, this is weird. You get up. It's not like church.
Yeah.
And then you get up, you make it all a bit neat and bow at it and things like that. Like, what is this about? It was one of the things I struggled with. But the more I read or sort of experienced and all the rest of it, what it seems to me, and I might be wrong, you know, is that the whole mat thing is sitting there is an awareness that actually you're filtering the whole world through your thoughts and your experiences and so on. And that's sort of liberating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you suddenly say, well, I'm not this thing that's subject to forces or the things out with my control. It's sort of a reminder or a practice which I found led me to realize I've got choices in how I respond to things,
mm-hmm,
including my own past.
Yeah.
You know, what comes off my head if I'm not thinking about anything else. And there's a peacefulness that comes from realizing that you have control with how you respond to things.
Yeah.
So it becomes a sort of, it's, yeah. Is that what maths, the whole process is, you know, is that right?
Yes. Yes. We talk about taking responsibility for whatever happens on the mat.
Hmm.
So we sit, as you said, we usually sit for 25 minutes at a time with what's called Kinhin, which is a walking meditation. And we usually do three sits with two kinhins. And of course, what arises on the mat is completely unpredictable. You know, within three sits, you know, you could have a really peaceful sit to start with. The second sit, for absolutely no reason that you can identify, you know, you just feel you're in an absolute whirl. And then the third sitting, it may be back to the peacefulness or something. But we just accept that what is going on the mat is me. So we take responsibility for ourselves. And you know, I've spoken about you know, when we're on the mat, we simply can't run away from who we are. The totality of our life is there on the mat. We're aware of it. As you said, it might be something that's arising from the past, or it might be something in the present, or it might suddenly be a great, you know, kind of sense of release, or a little movement of awakening. But everything that happens on the mat is who we are, and we just accept it.
I've got my producer saying we've got to stop chatting, Chris. I've got like 1,000 more questions. It's so interesting chatting to you. Anyone listening today, if they're listening in today, what could you say to them? Hmm. What encouragement do you have for anyone listening today about the connections between flourishing and awakening to themselves?
Yeah, yeah. We often speak in Zen of being perfect as we are. That seems a slightly odd thing to say when for many of us, if not all of us, our experience is, well, you've got to be joking, I don't feel perfect. What it means is that absolutely everything that we need for our awakening, for our flourishing, for our being truly who we are, is right here and now. Absolutely everything. So I would say trust in your own innate love, compassion, acceptance, trust in your own perfection in that sense, trust from a Christian point of view, trust that you are deeply and forever loved, and nothing can ever alter that. And whichever one helps, I think they bring us to a very similar place, really. Mm.
Trust and love. Thank you so much.
Gillian, thank you.
It's been lovely talking to you.
Well, it's been an absolute joy, and thank you so much. It was wonderful to meet on that session. I'm so pleased that you were able to come. I mean, next time you can bring your husband with you.
Now we have our arguments afterwards. Now we thought about it. No, it's been great. And you've written a book on the subject as well, haven't you? This crossover. Yeah. So we'll link to that in lovely. The show notes as well.
Thank you.
And we will be picking up this conversation over in our Go Health community, which is a group of people committed to exploring all this, exploring how to flourish faithfully today and to being a healing presence in the world. And I really heard that in your final, what you said there. You know, if we know how loved we are, we can show love to others. That is being a healing presence. Thank you to Rosie Dawson, who is our producer, and to Wendy Lloyd from the Go Health team for all her work in this series and podcast. If you're listening today and being inspired, please do hit share and tell others about this podcast and the work of the Go Health community, where we seek to flourish and be a healing presence in our world today. Thank you so much, Chris. It's been great chatting with you.
Julian, thank you so much. It's been a joy.